We are coming now to the report of Sibylle Benning, Sustainable Urban Development Fostering Social Inclusion. And it's continuing what we discussed a little bit with the Luis Leite Ramos report and with Mr. Kiefer from the Congress of Region and Villages. We have a guest with us, Mr. Joachim Schulz-Granberg. Now I have nothing about you, but you will introduce yourself, I hope. But first I give Mrs. Benning the floor to introduce into her report.
Ja, sehr geehrter Herr Schenach, sehr geehrte Kollegen, die langsam alle aus der Mittagspause wiederkommen und wieder wach werden. Ich freue mich heute sehr, dass Sie heute den Expertenvortrag zu meiner Berichterstattung anhören können. Nachhaltige Stadtentwicklung ist mir nämlich ein Herzensthema, denn ich bin überzeugt, dass viele der sozialen Probleme, die wir in diesem Ausschuss besprechen, mit einer klugen Stadtentwicklungspolitik an der Wurzel gepackt werden können. Und um hier auch direkt meinen Vorschlag aus der Debatte zur Nachhaltigkeit eben aufzugreifen, diese Berichterstattung bezieht sich auf das SDG-Ziel Nummer 11, Sustainable Cities and Communities der Vereinten Nationen. So bleiben wir gleich am Thema dran. Aber verstehen Sie mich nicht falsch, der ländliche Raum soll hier nicht vergessen werden. Meine Position ist, dass wir nur mit gleichwertigen Lebensverhältnissen in Stadt und Land eine gute Politik machen können. Und als Diplomgeografin weiß ich auch sehr genau, dass Städte nicht ohne das ländliche Umfeld auskommen und Raumplanung hier grenzüberschreitend gedacht werden muss. Aber nun zum Thema. Wie Sie mit Sicherheit wissen, geht der Trend in Europa und auch weltweit zu einer zunehmenden Urbanisierung. Bis 2050 werden knapp 70% der Menschen in Städten leben. Bereits heute spüren wir einen großen Druck auf die Städte. Und dazu zählen der knapper werdende Wohnraum, Probleme von sozialer und kultureller Segregation und Auswirkungen auf die Umwelt. Und gerade auch der Klimawandel erfordert Anpassungsstrategien in den Städten, damit CO2-Emissionen sinken und auch bei Hitze die Lebensqualität in verdichteten Städten erhalten bleibt. Ziel meiner Berichterstattung ist es, Aufmerksamkeit auf die Bedeutung einer klugen Stadtentwicklung zu lenken, die auf dem Vorbild der europäischen Stadt basiert. Dass wir uns heute ausgerechnet in Lissabon, einer der lebenswertesten Städte Europas, hierüber austauschen dürfen, das freut mich natürlich besonders. Sie haben es in Ihrer Einführung zu dieser Tagung, Herr Schenner, schon gesagt, dass es eine besondere Stadt ist. Fußgängerfreundliche Städte, in denen Leben und Arbeiten nebeneinander passieren und eine soziale Durchmischung existiert, sind hierfür Vorbild. Eine gute Verkehrsanbindung, besonders auch neue und umweltschonende Mobilität und umfassende Bildungsangebote sind entscheidende Zukunftsinvestitionen. Und gleichzeitig können wir nur mit ausreichend hochwertigen Grünflächen und öffentlichen Räumen für alle Bürger eine hohe Lebensqualität erreichen. Gerade im verdichteten Raum brauchen wir hierfür neue Konzepte. Als Landschaftsarchitektin möchte ich mich hierfür besonders einsetzen. Für nachhaltige Stadtentwicklung und durchmischte Baukonzepte gibt es in Europa schon herausragende Beispiele, die Schule machen sollten. Daher freue ich mich, dass Sie nun meinen Experten anhören dürfen, Herrn Schulz-Granberg. Herr Professor Schulz-Granberg ist Architekt und Professor für Städtebau an der Fachhochschule in Münster und auch selbst aktiv in der Stadtplanung tätig. Und herzlich willkommen, dass Sie alle da sind. Und schön, dass Sie hier sein können. Und ich gebe das Wort an Sie, Herr Schulz-Granberg, und vielleicht stellen Sie sich kurz noch eben vor.
One moment. At the beginning of our conference, I said exactly, Lisbon is my late love in my life. And you know, the problem with late loves is that loves put also tears in your eyes sometimes. And one of the tears when I hear the name Lisbon is that Lisbon has had 1 million citizens 10 years ago and now not 300,000. And there is a reason for that. And And that makes me really sad, because it's the only capital in Europe which lose citizens. This is, but this is another story, but it's a social story for a social committee. Yeah? Herr Professor, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for introducing me. Thank you very much for having me here. And thank you, hopefully, for your attention. You heard my name, Joachim Schulz-Granberg. I have two professional positions. One is at the University of Applied Science in Münster, and the other is my office for urban design, sustainable cities, and master planning in Berlin. So these two professional positions are fed by one hat. This is the round thing between my shoulders, and it is this hat is deeply concerned with urban design and urban planning. And urban design, you can say, is simply the discipline taking care of arranging houses, green infrastructure, squares, and so on. This is obviously true, but this is also not enough, because urban planning is also about demography, statistics, culture, behavior, cohabitation, and last but not least, social questions. This is what I would like to talk about today, urban planning and social questions, social integration, social inclusion. Urban planning is also a question, you could say, why are some neighborhoods so popular and people really like it, and why are some other neighborhoods not so popular? So this is very hard to answer sometimes, and so that's why I'm very interested in that topic. And there's something wrong here, but I know what was wrong. Sorry. And this is a mirror image of myself. So I'm really interested in city development, and so the city is my profession and my passion, and I'm very much interested about what a city is and what a city can become. And let's talk about this, what a city can become. And I would like to invite you to follow me for the next 10 minutes into these three chapters. What a city can be. So it could be an incubator, but that has a question tag, so it needs some explanation. I would like to introduce you to some best practice projects, and I would like to recommend or give a recommendation about actions you could take. So I came here also with a big trust in you as a European Council to be able to change the world within the cities, change the cities for the future, because in 2050, 66% of all the inhabitants will live in cities. So that means that when you will change the way we live together in the cities, you can change a lot, you can contribute to sustainability. But first, to the first point, I think the city is at the moment our condition. It's our natural or artificial environment, it's our urban nature, and the city is something like a teacher to us. So when we are born, it takes at least 1 or 2 years that we are able to use toilets, and it takes 18 years that we can do a driving license, and it takes maybe 30 years that we have a full set of moral understanding of the world. So we are a kind of political animal. We are a kind of political animal existing in public space, and we live under the protection of the family, and we live in a public culture that we share with other species. And so I'm talking about the public space, and this is a very famous map of the public space in Rome, the so-called Nolli map. And so the interesting part of that map is just the white, because this is the place where people meet, where people are able to walk, and you can see that it's outside space here, and it's also inside space with all the cathedrals and churches, which is in fact public space, open space, accessible space. We can be there. So this model of open city is a very interesting model, and it's the model of the European city. You can see the Google results saying European city, and here you can see Lisbon, and you see a lot of other cities you're probably coming from. So we're talking about the European city and the future of the European city, and we're talking about what a city is able to do when you plan it right. So it is about public space. What you can see on your left-hand side, that's in Poland. So it's not about shopping malls, because shopping malls have a long set of regulations, and of course you can't do what you would like to do. So we're talking about market squares, we are talking about streets, we are talking about public space in that sense, and a kind of open city, a conditio urbana on the right-hand side, and which is a kind of very positive way of living together. And I'm talking about this because it is not so easy that you can guarantee that, because we have also, let's say, city of competitive clusters, like on the left-hand side, and that happens because the general trend we are undergoing at the moment is that the public sector is withdrawing from urban development and housing construction, and not only as a landowner and investor, but also as a weakening regulatory authority. So if you look at Berlin, you have a very interesting statistics that between 2001 and 2015, Berlin sold 1,600 hectares of public space, and now it's reducing its ability to influence urban development. Urban development is made by private investors, and they are probably a number of really good private investors, but their main interest is not to support the common good and to support the public space. So you have like potatoes, like on the left-hand side, and all these potatoes have an own logic, and each potato doesn't even know who's his neighbor. So it's a kind of a city of individual development. And so this is the tendency at the moment, and I think politics and municipalities should be able to maintain the city as a kind of open city, as a resource, as that quote says here. And this resource needs maintenance, that needs care, that needs some kind of regulations, and this can make the city a very interesting, a very good place. I would like to recommend a book to you very shortly before I come to the best practice. This is The City of the Arrival. The book of Arrival City is written by a journalist, not an architect, and this book is also about European cities. This all the red titles here, so there is there's London, Poland, Paris, France, Turkey, Germany, Spain, the Netherlands, and this is the history of migration in the cities. So our cities have a history of migration, and migration usually turns out to be very positive in the long term. So he found out that in the second or third generation, the migrants start to study as well-acknowledged universities and start to become members of society, influencing society, enriching society. So the quote I would like to give to you is, so people come in as migrants, they leave as citizens. So the city is a kind of teacher for us, helping us to become like citizens, and helping us to become social and political animals. So the city is a teaching ground for society. And this is a very, very short summary of the big theoretical debate about it, a very interesting debate, but I don't want to bother you with this, but let me show you some kind of practical examples. And so now it's getting much less theoretic, and I hope you can follow a little bit. I compiled six references, which are on one hand projects about living and community and on the other hand proactive neighborhoods. And due to the time I have, I would like to show you only two of these projects, the two left projects, and we start with a city in Germany, a small city called Tübingen, which is not far away from Strasbourg, almost on the same latitude. And Tübingen had a lot of developments in the last few years, starting in the 90s. And you see the French Quarter, the so-called Loreto, the mill district, the old weaving mill, and so on. So that they developed a lot of housing for 2,700 inhabitants. You can read it on the slide. And they also created jobs. So they created a kind of very interesting mix of functions. And that's quite extraordinary. Look at new projects within the city. It is luxury apartments, or it is industry or shops or commercial. But usually it's hard to find mix in new developments. So they were very successful doing that here. And why I'm showing you that is it is a kind of procedure behind. It's a so-called concept tender procedure. And this procedure has a list of parameters which are important to develop the city. So it's about density. It is about cities and urbanity, about public space, about mixed use and diversity, and about ground floors which are open and active, and so on. And this list of criteria is applied before an investor buys a plot. So here you have a plan in Germany there, and you can buy a plot, for instance, that one for 8 flats or that one for 20 flats and so on. And before you can buy that, you have to undergo this procedure. And this procedure is very interesting because the city is calling for concepts. They're asking investors, potential investors, like, please, what would you like to have? 8 flats, 20 flats, a mix. And they are asking the people, please, give us a concept about diversity, about urbanity, about mix, and people deliver concepts. That's the PDF with 10 pages, and then starts a selection procedure. And the selection procedure works like a traffic light. You have red, yellow, and green, and on based of those create criteria, which are predefined, they choose the best projects. And then these investors, they're getting an option for the plot, and this option is like for half a year, and then they have to come back, they have to show their financing, and they have to make everything complete. And when everything is complete and they have a positive talk, then the investor is able to buy the plot. And this makes the city really strong, because they are able to influence the urban development very much. And if an investor comes and doesn't have all the municipal criteria, then say, no, sorry, next one, please. So, and I'm talking about encouraging cities and municipalities being strong and choosing their investors. It's like a wedding. You don't marry the first person you meet on the street. You look at this person. You wait a little bit. You look at the qualities. You want to see that person in a good mood and in a bad mood. And then you think of marrying, maybe. So let's take some time and before building and selling plots. Because when you sold a plot, and when you have a project, then it's done for the next 50 years. You can't change it. So the influence of the city is really low. I show you a few images from Tübingen. You see public transport. You see bicycle traffic, very pedestrian-friendly streets. You see green. You see wonderful courtyards. You see nice public space. You see terraces, balconies, places to be, places to stay. And this is a city which has experienced since 1995 with this procedure. They are very successful. They are growing, and they are kind of groundbreaking for this tender procedure. First example. And I have a second one, which is not the planning for a whole city. This is a kind of building project in Zurich in Switzerland. It's called Kalkbreite. I can't translate that. That's just an own name, Kalkbreite. And this is this building. And the interesting thing about that building is it is built on an old tram depot. You know trams from Lisbon, maybe from your city. So here you see there are trams under it, and this is buildings around it, and there's a public courtyard on top of the tram depot, so you see the trams inside that building. So that's the inside of the building, and here you can see offices looking at the tram depot inside. So it's a very complicated construction. There's the tram coming out from the building, and you see flats on top and offices on top. And it is was a long procedure, and this procedure was made by a housing association in German, Wohnbaugenossenschaft, and so they developed the whole project with the staircases going up to the courtyard. So the trams are inside. Next to the trams, there are cafes and so on. You enter the courtyard. You look at the courtyard. You have roof terraces. You have a sauna. You have gardens. You have a lobby for like welcoming you, and you have a library, and it's all kind of shared facilities for the inhabitants. And the interesting thing is that you have a number of something like a couple of hundred flats, but also all these colors here on that image is commercial functions. And these commercial functions are quite stunning. You have a bar, you have a kitchen, you have places for celebrating your birthday, you have some kind of kindergarten facilities, you have a little cinema, you have different restaurants, you have a flower shop, and you have a place for people without papers, sans papier, who can come here. And you even have a place for women who are migrated, having no passport and have to give birth, so they can come here and be there. So this is not a residential development. Yes, it is, but it's much more. And this is a mix of really very interesting functions. And it's such a good, let's say, element, component for the city, because it absorbs a lot of cultural and social life from the surrounding, which can happen within that development. So you have more developments, some of them are in Vienna. Vienna has very interesting development procedures at the moment. There's one in Berlin. I guess you got the paper we delivered with this, so you can read about the other developments. They are a little bit comparable to the Kalkbreite in Zurich. The Kalkbreite was one of the first projects being very groundbreaking, and a lot of other projects came in here. So there's a hotel for migrants. There is a residential project where you have also a lot of facilities, affordable housing. This is a project. Students and homeless people built that house, and they made a restaurant, and the bankers come here and have lunch in the restaurant. So it's not an alternative project, it's an official project. And there's a project in Berlin also about housing. You can read in these books. We published about that. You find most of these projects here in those books. And the interesting thing is that there is much more to come, and this is why I probably stand here in front of you, to find some vectors of action to support these kind of projects, because they will promote and support social inclusion, they will promote public ground, and they will strengthen municipal interests. So I have compiled 6 vectors of action, and I'm almost done. So I would think that the first step is raise the municipal attention for alternative developments. Forget books. Look at your city. Look at what's happening, and try to integrate or to consider these kind of developments which are happening there, and try to have the kind of list of mixed use and pedestrian friendly developments enriching the municipal environment. So it's such as this image. Yeah, you see that and think that's not possible, but it is possible, and that's the interesting thing about the city. It can always surprise yourself. So raise the intention. Second, it is an empowerment of municipal decision makers. So it is a little bit I sometimes think that urban development is sometimes quite weak, because it's a kind of daily business, and our municipalities, they are much too, our, when I say that, I talk about Germany, they are busy with really small-scale building projects, and they're working there 3 days for, like, the building permit for a little garage. Doesn't make sense. So let's go to the big questions, and let's be very clear that we should support the community designing and placemaking processes. So it is about hard facts, like selling plots, real estate, and so on, but it's also about soft factors like potential for integration and bottom-up projects. When you do that, I think you should have guidelines, but these guidelines should be not constraints, but incentives. I show you a really nice example, and this example took place about 100 years in Boston. So there was a developer who wanted to build a skyscraper, and then the city came, yes, we would like to have some public ground. Then the developer said, yes, but I'm earning not enough money when I make that public. I can't earn money with public ground. I want to sell it or rent it out. Then the city said, don't you build more stories on top? But then we have a public ground. This is a win-win. This is a really good guideline, because the developer has all the square meters he needs for developing his building, but you have a public ground, maybe a subway station, a kind of square on the ground floor. So a city will profit from these kind of developments. Then, fourth point is consider these kind of concept tender procedures, because it sounds very easy. It is easy, but this needs political support and encouragement to undergo such a procedure, because this is not the normal status quo of our planning at the moment, but it is can be very successful. Fifth point is acknowledge bottom-up activity, and there's a lot of literature, like the book on the right-hand side, Self-Made City. There's a lot of do-it-yourself initiatives in our city, and these initiatives are sometimes very valuable, because they doesn't take up capacities of our planning authorities, because citizens do it themselves. It needs a kind of guideline for integrating them within the cities. And there are many examples going on here, and also the digitalization helps to create a kind of a digital platform for communities and for crowdsourcing projects and social networks to be built. And last but not least, it is also about the ground. And how could you strengthen these kind of ideas? Because I'm standing in front of you, as I sometimes stand in front of a city or a municipality. I give some recommendations. Everybody's happy. You shake hands. You're looking forward to a brilliant future. But in the end, not much happens. So I think it needs engaged people within cities who are continuously following urban development, monitoring projects and looking for qualities. And I think there should be a budget for that, and this budget could be easily generated with this kind of circle behind me, which is the value-added chain with high turnovers when you start to convert agricultural land into building land, when you construct the buildings and when you develop that land. There's a lot of money involved, and I think you should use that money for supporting a kind of monitoring procedure for urban development. So, basically, this is my very short introduction. Here you see all the guidelines, and I think if you politically support the idea of a city as an incubator, as a place of fostering communal interests and integration and social inclusion, then you can have a place for nurturing social cohesion, fruitful cohabitation, creative communication, and social benefits, as long as it offers conditions for unfolding the common good. Thank you very much for listening. And if you have questions, please go ahead.
Okay, the first who called for the floor is John O'Reilly, please.
Thank you, Mr. President, for the opportunity to intervene. Could I, at the outset, pay a very genuine and warm tribute to our colleague from Germany, Sybil, who has brought forward this report and has put a lot of thought into it and presented it very well. And it's a very relevant discussion. And also to thank the Professor for his inputs. I try to ask a set of questions rather than make a set of speeches on each issue. I'll address a number of questions which I think might be more fruitful in the long run. What do you think, Professor, and indeed Sybil, of the concept of building up? We have a lot of cities tend to be lateral out, and there's a shortage of space, and they're building very far out with consequent pressure on services, on transport, and on all the services, and the delivery of services outside the city. So do you think building up is a good idea? And if you go building up, how do you prevent social problems arising from the building up? How do you prevent intergenerational alienation within those communities? And that's the second challenge. The next question that I'd like to ask you is, how do you think you could get over the status issue in public housing? Do you know the problem that, and it's our fault, it's collectively our own fault, in the way that we've done it, and as you said, the drift to the private sector completely in building, in latter years particularly. I'd like if we could restore, when I was a child, there was a great, in all countries that I knew, and my UK colleagues would be able to say the same, I think, there was a great status with social housing, council estates. There was a great pride in them, and there was a great self-belief, and a feeling that they were no different, and why should there be to anyone else? Now there's a level of snobbiness involved there, snobbery. So could you suggest how we might get over some of that? The point that you make about, I'd like to ask you about the leases and the rent, the cost of accommodation and the cost of purchasing houses. How could we overcome this with long leases, with competitive rents, and yet make them sufficiently profitable for the private sector to have an involvement? The point that you make about the multicultural dimension is well made, and I understand it and take it. But can I ask you about the choosing of projects by a different criteria to the normal tendering? Obviously, money would be an element of that, I assume, the prices. But did you say that the people would vote on options first? The people would present a set of options first, then the officials of the city would present them to the various builders and ask them to tender accordingly. Is that the process? And the only question that arises from that is, would that become prohibitively expensive? Would it make the entire development beyond the reach of ordinary people? And maybe explain how not. And I understand. Now, I think myself there's a lot of room for more student accommodation, purpose-built student accommodation in cities. Because what I, and I'm going to finish, there's only a set of couple of questions. What I find is that in cities, the students are dotted all over in apartments, and they're taking up place from families. And I think universities should be asked and encouraged to build purpose-built student accommodation. And you might comment on that. Basically, the last and final point is the big issue is cost and accessibility, that houses have gone beyond. And obviously, I presume you would say that the solution lies in supply. Does the solution lie in supply? And then does the solution lie in supply of the worst type of housing, just to get over the cost issue? Because my experience is that most people now are not able to buy a home. Most people are not even able to rent. And it's become a crisis, and I'd like you to comment on that. And thanks, President, for your indulgence. I did avoid making speeches. It's much better that we elicit information. Thank you.
I want to try to give you an answer. I'm from Vienna. I think it's the capital of social housing in Europe. 480,000 apartments are social housings and belongs more or less to the community. And what we try is to make a mix of, if you have an area, maybe a former factory or like that, then you need different kinds of offers. Social housing which are only from the community. Then the mixture, it's called in German Genossenschaft, it's half-half. You pay a little bit, but you are not an individual owner. And this is something what is in your spirit or what is in the society. Nobody in Vienna is running for a private house or private apartment. I have also not, because everybody wants to rent. And why we should have ownership? We want to rent. Third, you need in this mixture also some more or less property, more property orientated, so that you have no social ghettos. But for that, you must build this area with a full support of different ways, education, free time, sport, and. And you have to realize that you are in a city where 160 nations are living. So what we are doing, everybody can ask for a piece of land and he can produce his vegetables there. The city of Vienna is preparing this piece of land and the people can go there. For example, in the center, there's a part of the river of Danube. There are everywhere the possibilities, for example, for homeless people to have their own vegetables and herbs. And nobody is stolen that. Yeah? You can believe when you put tomatoes in that area, nobody comes in the night and take away your tomatoes. So you have to offer and you have to open a city. We just finished a part of our city and it's called Sea City. Because you must put an attraction. And the attraction is the public transport. For example, it's a holy message in Vienna. No civil services and communal services are never privatized. It's all in the hand of the municipality. From the waste management, from the park management, from the transport management, everything is doing by the city itself. And you have always jump on the modern sustainability aspects. For example, in Vienna, we are not cooling with fossil energy. All hospitals, everything, all universities, the cooling is only the other side. You can, with waste, heating and make electricity, or you can cooling. So you must always be on the technique of renewable energy. And then the people love the city. Then you give them the feeling you are a part of that. And you must give them a chance in the development. And I was 19 years in a district responsible. And always the people came and said, the foxes makes problems. Huh? We have a lot of foxes. We have white beaks, foxes, and. And I told them, you are living such a nice surrounding. You have to accept that you have to share the place. We cannot kill all the foxes. We cannot kill all the wild pigs. Be happy that you have this and that you not run to the zoo. You go only out of your door and then you see. For example, I have on my terrace always by full moon is a fox. Yeah? And all the people say, Mr. Schenach, you're a fox. I said, no, it's our fox. Realize, it's our fox. Yeah? So that is the way where you have to debate with people and where you can develop a city. But first, and thank you that you brought this example, refugees build a hotel. The city gave them a hotel. That is the decision you have to do as city. We gave the people who are sick on AIDS, what is SIDA? SIDA in English? AIDS people, they get a house. They can do what they want. They have their structures there. We support. When some people occupied areas, then you have to talk with them. Then you have to create something. One of our nicest area, it was occupied 30 years ago, is now the home place of the first feminist gymnasium of Vienna. It's the home place of so many things. And the refugees got the house and they built and they created a hotel. And everybody's going there. Come on. When there are very high level bankers, as he said, where they go for the dinner? Where they go? They go in the hotel of the refugees. Because you have to take care for this process. And then it's helping. But you have to think more in that way. And this is to create the place. I can only tell you, maybe for your next lecture, there is a part of Stockholm. It was a devastated area. Docks, everything was awful. And now everybody wants to live there. Why? They made the completely system of renewable and waste management and the ferry, because you have to go on the other side of the sea, it's free. There is no car. So we have also in Vienna areas without cars, without individual cars. And you cannot believe that the people are waiting to can live in areas without cars. But for that you need pedestrian ways and you need bicycle ways and you have to open. You know what you have to pay in Vienna for the tram, for the subway? €1 per day. You can, 24 hours you can drive. €1. Yeah. It's only €1. Huh? And if you have this, you have other possibilities. Okay, this is only an appeal that the city is a city for the people, and the people have to find themselves in a city and not to be loneless, and you have to offer a lot in that way. So, sorry, but communal policy is always something which touched my heart very well. And I was 19 years in when I started politics in a communal area, and I was sitting at 7 in the morning in the committee for building and construction, and after 1 hour later in the budget thing. So this is where you get really the feeling. But you have to discuss with the citizens. Madame Pomasco.
Thank you very much for this interesting comment and presentation and debate. And it also shows that city policies are really different in different countries. Because I'm coming from Gdańsk, from the north of Poland, very dynamic city, especially in the last years. But at the same time, we have something opposite. No one wants to rent the flat. We all want to own a flat in Poland. And it causes a lot of problems as well. And my question is also about that. The problem we challenge in Gdańsk and in many cities in Poland, that whenever you have a new residential area built in the center of the city, because Gdańsk, Wrocław, other cities were destroyed a lot during the war, so we still have a lot of space in the center to build new houses, and it's always built by private companies and private real estate companies. The problem is the prices to buy a flat are really high. That means that there are no residents there, because we are not that rich society yet. It means that all these flats in the center are sold to foreigners or those who want to rent to someone flats. It means that it's not never long-term rental, but it's always short-term rental means for parties, stuck parties and stuff like that. And it means that it completely destroys the city, and like city of Gdańsk and other cities, because it doesn't build a city. In fact, it destroys the city. You have a new great investment, sometimes really done in a really nice way, but there is no profit for the city as a whole. So if I may ask for comment about that, like how to deal with that, because we are thinking about some also law regulations about like to forbid to rent flats, but it's not that easy. So it's
only one sentence. I think one of the most important things for the policy in a city is to make a reserva of land. Because if you are always fighting with the private sector, you always lose and you cannot offer cheap. Maybe if you did not make a reserva, it's too late. But sometimes you have the chance to get something back in reserva. Maybe if a railway station is destroyed or like that, then you take it immediately back. But can I take Serhii Kiral and he is our special expert for decentralization. And so we take one, two, but Sibylle Wenning is the last one. You make the closing remarks, please.
Thank you. I think this discussion, this debate proves also the significance of the report that we have started to work within this committee on air pollution. Because, in fact, I haven't heard, whether in your presentation or in other presentations, that there was a reference to the public health issues as the key detrimental element in city planning, for example, urban planning. So do the architects or do the city planners, the mayors, do they take into account when they make important decisions on public spaces, on shopping centers, on other, on social housing as well, you know, to what extent and how the health of the people who are going to go there, work for leisure or going to live there, will be affected, to what extent this area is already polluted, and maybe there has to be some other decisions to be taken. So I wonder if you are within this professional environment, to which extent it is already been noticed and taken into account. Maybe you are aware that the World Health Organization has been recently, at least within the last 5 years, very active in providing certain expertise and certain even guidelines and tools for the urban planners as related with the reference to the issues like air pollution and public health. There is a new working group being established led by the city of Utrecht, which is also going to be part of this first meeting of the urban planners, particularly related to public health, in which is going to take place in Belfast, actually, in Belfast in October 1st through 4th. And then also we hope to participate in the Geneva meeting, which is also to be the first meeting related to the development and public health network. So I think these kind of developments, which are a trend right now, which is going on, they just only reflect the present issues of the problems like with air pollution and other public health problems, that they should not be just discussed in scientific conferences, but should also be already being integrated in the different planning procedure. So I would would like your comment just to see from the real sector whether this is already there or it's still up there somewhere. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now, Luis, you're the next one.
Muito, muito obrigado. Eu queria começar por cumprimentar e felicitar a relatora por este oportuno e excelente relatório. Eu julgo que é um tema da maior utilidade e atualidade. Queria também cumprimentar o nosso convidado pela excelente apresentação que fez e na sequência daquilo que disse a nossa colega polaca, eu gostaria de trazer um problema, enfim, que é muito atual em Portugal e em Lisboa em particular e que também na minha opinião, deveria ser equacionado neste relatório. Tem a ver com as dinâmicas de turismo que algumas cidades, enfim, nem todas ao mesmo ritmo, como foi dito, nem todas ao mesmo tempo, mas em Portugal nós temos neste momento um problema muito grave. Uma grande parte da cidade de Lisboa e também do Porto estavam, enfim, com uma mistura e um mix social muito grande, não por boas razões, mas porque grande parte do património edificado, das habitações, estavam degradadas ou não tinham as melhores condições. O boom turístico, provocado não só pelas companhias low cost, mas também por um nível de vida relativamente barato, por um nível de segurança muito elevado, fez com que, em poucos anos, a pressão imobiliária se instalasse em toda a cidade. E aqueles que eram bairros onde havia este mix social, onde havia uma grande diversidade, de um momento para o outro, começaram a ser objeto e a ter um interesse muito especial por parte não só de investimentos privados individuais, mas sobretudo de grandes fundos de investimento internacionais. E aquilo que constituía o fator de atração turística da cidade, que era a sua genuinidade, ou seja, aquele particular mais genuíno, acabou por ser, ou está a ser destruído, no fundo, por este tipo de dinâmica. Claro que há aqui um debate nacional, saber se nós devemos ou não regular este investimento e estes fluxos e de que forma é que o devemos regular. O Parlamento acaba de aprovar uma lei que endossa ou remete para as municipalidades, para o município, para a cidade de Lisboa, grande responsabilidade em regular parte dos fluxos turísticos. Mas há um problema. Hoje em dia não são as classes mais baixas que estão a ser corridas do centro da cidade, são as classes médias. Hoje em dia uma classe média não pode, um casal com rendimentos médios não pode viver no centro da cidade. E portanto isto coloca um problema muito grave, porque de um momento para o outro esta pressão imobiliária que continua está a transformar completamente a cidade. Aqui a questão já não é tanto as novas edificações, as novas expansões urbanísticas. Este é um tema que me interessa e eu tenho que fazer esta declaração de interesses, porque do ponto de vista académico e do ponto de vista profissional, eu tenho dedicado parte da minha vida nos últimos anos a estudar e a trabalhar estas questões e não posso estar mais de acordo quanto à abordagem que é feita, perfeitamente de acordo. Mas esta realidade de Lisboa e do Porto coloca novos desafios. Até onde é que deve, e a minha questão é esta, até onde é que deve ir a regulação? Se a questão da oferta da habitação social, que nós também tivemos no passado, mas tem riscos, porque, como dizia o Stefano, cria também muitas vezes alguns guetos e não promove ela própria uma mistura e uma diversidade social que todos nós queremos. Mas a minha pergunta é, como é que deve ser feita essa regulação, em que termos e de que forma é que nós podemos garantir, claro está, com a intervenção do Estado, não tenho dúvidas que não há muitas formas diferentes de a fazer, mas como é que nós podemos fazer para garantir esta diversidade neste contexto da reabilitação, da regeneração urbana, das cidades e das áreas mais tradicionais? Muito obrigado.
Thank you, Louise. I have one ask for the floor more, Mrs. McCarthy.
Yeah. Just a very quick question. I don't think I've ever been to a city that would be as difficult for somebody with mobility issues, so wheelchair user, for example, as Lisbon. As I've been walking around, you know, the pavements are so narrow, the cobbles, the trams wouldn't be accessible. And I just wondered, I mean, you talk here about mobility and accessibility, but there must be a lot of cities where you're dealing with the historical context where the new development could be accessible, but I can't see how you would ever... I'd be interested to hear from the Portuguese colleagues, actually, but it seems to me like most of Lisbon would be a no-go area, say for my niece who's a wheelchair user.
Try with a Kinderwagen to go to Venezia, for example. Then you think Lisbon is a paradise for that. But it's okay. It's only a short remark. Please, there was a lot of questions. And after you, give the floor to Mrs. Penny.
Okay. There were really many questions. I'm very happy that you commented and that I have the feeling that you listened, and I really liked what you said. Let's start the other way around with your question. There are conferences about the European city, and the conferences, they are saying that the ideal cities are like Venice, like Lisbon, like Porto, like the inner city of Paris, and so on. And the funny thing is that most of the building regulations we have, they doesn't allow to replicate these cities. We love them, but we can't. But maybe it's good, because everything we do now should be kind of barrier-free, but when you have topography like in Lisbon, it's impossible. So I think you should be very careful keeping the qualities you have, but for new developments, trying to do best to integrate elevators and barrier-free settings. I think for every new development you should do that, but you should not kill the old developments. Then I think you would delete your own culture. Then the tourist question, I think, is very interesting. And I think how much you talked about, there were comments about social housing, about stability of prices. And I think tourism is good for a city because you get money, but you can also be killed by tourism. I think Lisbon changed a lot. Most of European cities changed a lot in the last few decades. And I think you have to look at every project you're realizing. You should have a kind of local list of criteria, communal criteria you want to integrate. So when there's a developer coming and showing you a concept and paying a lot of money, you should appreciate the money, but you should say, like, what is the city getting from your project? A fence, an open door, a courtyard, a public space, a nice ground floor, or a nice top floor with a view for everybody. You should ask for that. And you should be really resistant and tell them, hey, it's a nice concept, but we would like to have this, this, and that. Try to integrate that. And of course, that will be a dialogue. And sometimes you will be successful, sometimes you will be less successful. But I think you have to really work on that list. And you have to be rejected. And I observed too many times that cities are really happy when investors come, and then they, oh, they're coming, and they're the big guys. Yeah, let's do that. And I know Warsaw, for instance, and there are so many real estate projects going on there, not made for the people who live there. And I think that should be a criteria, have projects for the people who live in the city. And how you can do that, and I think that relates to the first comment and to your comment also, how can you get a long-term guarantee that whatever you do will also be affordable? And look at the tradition of housing associations. And housing associations are the most stable configuration of creating space for like long-term affordability. And there's a tradition in Berlin from the 20s, there's a Viennese tradition, so I think they're very good examples that these are usually much better than normal investor projects, because sometimes investors produce houses, they get a binding that some flats have to be cheap for the next 5 years, but what happens after 5 years? Then the prices go up like that. So you need this kind of long-term stability, and I think social housing could also play a role, and we said goodbye to social housing in many countries in Europe, and I think this is a way of you should also consider to reintegrate social housing. And maybe it will be different than 20 or 30 years ago, but you should have a kind of a list of criteria for the amount of rents and prices. And you usually say that when you earn money, you should spend not much more than one-third of your money for your flat. When you spend much more than one-third, like in Paris, like in London, then the balance is destroyed, and then you can't really afford a good life. And I don't know if I answered all questions. If I might have not answered them, I'm open for dialogue, but I tried my best to cover a little bit, but I will also be here when you have questions. Talk to me, please.
Thank you very much, Sibyl. Benning, you have now the floor. We are a little bit in running out of the time, so please briefly, if it's possible.
Ich möchte mich erst einmal für das ganz große Interesse, also ich habe selten eine Debatte so gesehen, dass alle so interessiert waren, verfolgt. Und es ist wirklich ein Prozess, den wir da anstoßen möchten, denn es ist wirklich ein wichtiges Thema, weil es wirklich die Menschen beschäftigt. Es beschäftigt sich mit vielen SDGs, also vor allen Dingen 11 nachhaltige Stadtentwicklung, aber mit den anderen eben auch. Alle Fragen kann man jetzt gar nicht beantworten, weil es ja auch, so wie Leiter Ramosch auch sagte, ein Prozess ist und wir möchten gerne eine Entwicklung für die Vielfältigkeit. Und das war ja auch Thema dieser Darstellung, dass man die Gegebenheiten nutzen muss, aber man muss eben auch sehen, wo man Einfluss ausüben kann. Und deswegen haben wir die Beispiele genannt. Das Thema der Touristik, das kennen wir aus Berlin auch. Das werden wir auch noch mit in unsere Ausführungen aufnehmen, genauso wie wir die Fragen notiert haben und versuchen, darauf dann auch noch Antworten zu geben, weil das ist zu vielfältig, das jetzt in dieser kurzen Debatte zu tun. Ich möchte nur sagen, wir sind nicht abgesprochen, aber in Deutschland tagt heute ein nationaler Kongress zur Stadtentwicklung. Und der Deutsche Städtebund, das ist nun die Vereinigung aller deutschen Städte, fordert heute in Deutschland einen Fonds für die Erschließung von Grundstücken und möchte gerne eine bundesweite Strategie, um aufeinander abgestimmte, nachhaltige und gemeinwohlorientierte Liegenschafts-, Boden- und Wohnungspolitik zu machen. Ich glaube, das fasst das ganz gut zusammen, was diese Motion auch bringen soll. Auch wir gehen in diese Richtung und werden das in unserer Ausführung aufnehmen. Und ich schließe einfach mit einem großen Dankeschön. Und Sie können gerne aber auch noch Fragen an mich, an uns schicken, die wir dann versuchen mit aufzunehmen. Ganz herzlichen Dank. Und natürlich einen ganz großen Dank auch Herrn Schulz-Granberg, der das so hervorragend dargestellt hat.
Danke, das trifft sich ja gut mit der Konferenz in Deutschland, dass wir genau zeitgleich hier sind. It's also the exact time for the Luis Ramos report regarding the regional and decentralization with the 30 years anniversary. And now I say thank you to you. Thanks to Sibylle Benning. And I will close now this item. And we move on. The societal impact of the platform economy is the next.
Thank you very much.
And the rapporteur is Luis Leite Ramos. And we have two guest speakers. Mr. Diago Sosa de Alte, he's a legal expert, and Mrs. Claudia Montero de Aguiar, she's a member of the European Parliament. Welcome, and Mr. Sosa de Alte, please take a seat, please. First, Luis, can you make some introductory remarks, please?
Muito obrigado. Duas ou três notas muito simples. Primeiro, esta realidade chamada economia das plataformas, economia da partilha, ou com outras designações conhecidas, é hoje uma realidade incontornável em todos os países, não só do Conselho da Europa, mas no mundo inteiro. E esta realidade, que tem hoje uma valia económica muito grande, que ao mesmo tempo mobiliza e movimenta um conjunto de atividades, cria um conjunto de empregos e também um conjunto de problemas novos para não só os vários Estados, mas também para os próprios agentes económicos. E, portanto, a pergunta que, de começo, para a elaboração deste relatório, tem muito a ver com três aspectos essenciais. Do ponto de vista dos consumidores, do ponto de vista dos agentes económicos, em matéria de emprego e dos direitos sociais do emprego, e em matéria de fiscalidade, quais são os grandes riscos e as grandes vantagens que existem relativamente a esta nova realidade. As informações que têm chegado, os relatórios que têm sido elaborados por várias instâncias na OCDE, no Parlamento Europeu, chamam a atenção para um conjunto de problemas e um conjunto de conflitos que devem ser estudados e analisados com toda a atenção, no sentido de fazer recomendações aos vários Estados e no sentido de produzir as alterações legislativas que são necessárias para defender esses direitos, sejam os direitos sociais, sejam os direitos económicos, e para garantir também a justiça fiscal, que é um dos aspectos que ultimamente temos muito discutido nesta Comissão e no Conselho da Europa, e é uma matéria muito importante. A discussão desta primeira nota introdutiva não podia ser mais oportuna em Portugal. Amanhã entra em vigor a nova lei das plataformas de transporte e vamos ter um conjunto de manifestações por parte dos operadores de táxi, pelo menos na capital e em frente ao Parlamento. Se amanhã tivéssemos cá a reunião, teríamos à nossa espera os taxistas portugueses que se impõem contra, ou que se manifestam contra esta nova lei. E, portanto, é este o enquadramento. O nosso objetivo é, no final, produzir um conjunto de recomendações para os vários Estados, de modo a cautelar estas três dimensões: defender os direitos dos consumidores, garantir os direitos sociais dos trabalhadores e, simultaneamente, assegurar que há justiça fiscal neste tipo de atividade económica, muito mais difícil de controlar, muito mais difícil de enquadrar naquelas que são as leis tradicionais. Eu gostava de agradecer, quer ao Tiago de Sousa Dalto, quer à Cláudia Monteiro de Aguiar. O Tiago de Sousa Dalto é um especialista português nestas matérias. Ele ajudou-nos a preparar o diploma que eu e o meu grupo parlamentar apresentou na Assembleia Portuguesa, no Parlamento Português, sobre as plataformas de transporte. E a Cláudia Monteiro de Aguiar é eurodeputada e trabalhou num relatório similar, enfim, com outro tipo de implicações e com outro enquadramento no Parlamento Europeu. E, portanto, são duas pessoas que nos podem ajudar a esclarecer muito estas matérias e a desfazer o debate que é necessário na preparação deste relatório. Muito obrigado.
Obrigado, Luís. Thank you very much. Welcome to our two experts. Normally in Austria we say ladies first, but in this case I think you should go into your memorandum. Yes, okay. Is it okay for you? Okay, please. The floor is yours.
Can I go to the stand?
You can. Yes.
Sim? Não. Sim. Também posso falar daí também, se calhar. Aqui? Está a falar? Estão a ouvir?
Sim, estou a falar para aqui.
Ah, muito bem. Ok. 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 Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the presentation. As Mr. Leiter Ramos said, I had the opportunity to provide some assistance in the Portuguese Parliament drafting the new law that enters into force tomorrow regarding transport platforms. And then Mr. Leiter Ramos was very kind to ask me to share some thoughts about the concerns that all these kind of platforms have or pose to today's society and the societal impact that it has on us all. The sharing economy is very simple. To put it in a simple way, it's basically a new way to do old business. There is none area of activity which is covered by platforms or electronic platforms that consists in a new business. It's just a new business model. Usually, what is new is the introduction of a new member in the relationship, where usually you have supply and demand. Now you have a third party that helps aggregate supply and demand. Now, the companies that provide this service, they allege they are merely intermediates and they have a neutral position in the business. The critics say that that is not so. They do not have a neutral position in this business, and they have actually a control of the business itself. This is very important because it helps us to understand that this new way of doing business, this new business model, is actually something quite new and defies our notions, our previous notions of business in a one-to-one relationship. And therefore, the center of gravity, the importance of this business model, is more in the operating platform than in the supply and demand of the service. Some critics go, well, a step further, saying that actually the big business model or the business case for these platforms is that it elopes, evades regulations that are usually applied to traditional businesses, and therefore that evasion to dire and strict regulations is what explains the affordability provided by that platform. You can see that in transport platforms or in housing platforms. The reason why the services which are provided through those platforms are so affordable, well, so cheap, is because people through those platforms do not have to comply with the harsh regulations which are usually imposed on transportation and on housing. Well, it is very important to understand to which level the platform is actually exerting some sort of control on the business and is just not a provider of electronic services. In the case of transport platforms, usually Uber and others, it is quite obvious that the platform is the decisive aspect of the business and that Uber and other platforms actually exert a control on the business. They define the list of the drivers available. They define the quality standards that must be followed by drivers. They provide a list of evaluation of the customers. They provide the services. People resort to Uber drivers, not because of the drivers, but because of Uber. So the distinctive trait of the platform is the platform itself. And therefore, it is nonsense to many people that these platforms should not be regulated as a part of the transportation business. Because the argument of the platform is, no, we are just helping people provide, or just helping to provide people with a new sort of mobility for the 21st century. We have absolutely nothing to do with the business of the driving itself. Drivers and customers are directly related, so all the regulations should rely upon them and not on us. So, as you see, this is basically what is in discussion here. Should legal obligations that apply usually to companies in the market should also apply to the platforms or not? Recently, we had a case, a very notorious case, that has been finally decided in the European Court of Justice. The Taxi Federation of Barcelona sued Uber, which was operating and is operating in Barcelona, saying that they should be qualified as a transport operator and therefore they should comply with all the same regulations that are applied to taxis. Taxis are an extreme case of conflict with Uber because upon the taxi sector, usually in every European city and even the United States, taxis share or the burden of regulation which is imposed by a limited number of taxis available in the market. What Uber was doing was evading this limitation and providing services without having to comply with those regulations. And so the case for the Spanish drivers was they are a transport company as well, even though they put a fancy dress called electronic platform, and therefore they should comply with the same regulations and the same limitations that we have to face every day. Making it short, the European Court of Justice did accept the case of the Spanish drivers, and qualified Uber as a transport operator, meaning that it must comply with all the regulations and the norms from the European functioning treaty and all the regulations applicable to regulation to the transport sector. Now, again, we may consider that these platforms of transportation have, they represent, they play a decisive role in the relationship, but they are not just as the same as a transport operator. They do introduce something new. So we cannot simply, or we should not simply, apply old rules to a new business. The challenge is to understand how this new way of doing business should be regulated, and the legal obligations should be shared by the platform, by the drivers, and by customers. And those are the legal challenges that this new way of mobility is posing to legislators throughout the world. Some of the problems that we see here in Portugal, they are visible also in other cities in the world, in Europe, and mainly in the United States. Uber initially started in the United States, and we see some problems arising there that have still not arrived to Europe, but eventually they will come, as we will see, namely of gender discrimination, racial discrimination, and other sort of discrimination, racial profiling, treatment of big data. Those are concerns posed by these platforms, and these are the challenges that legislators must address. The first, I think, the problem that should worry all legislators is the need for harmonized regulation. These platforms, they do not apply for permits in a nationwide scale. They usually apply for local level activity, meaning municipality to municipality. For instance, in Portugal, they do not work in the entire country. They work in Lisbon, in Oporto. They're expanding to the Algarve, and if you go to Spain and other countries, it's the same. So they usually deal with local authorities. This means that these companies have to deal with different rules depending on the city they are. It makes the compliance costs extremely high. Supposing that each local authority decides to apply its own regulations with its own specificities, it makes the compliance costs of these companies extremely high. And therefore, it will be a challenge for legislators to apply commonplace rules, at least at a nationwide scale, if not in European scale. Well, a new challenge as well is how to create new rules for a new service. Well, this is typically a legal problem, but when you have a purchase contract or a service contract, you have two parties in a contract. But in these contracts, you have three parties. You have the supplier, I mean the driver. You have the demand, which is the customer, and you have a third party. How do you regulate these contracts, which are made by three parties? You need new rules. Who is to share the burden of the insurance requirements? Who has to respond for keeping up with quality standards? Who is in charge of taking care of all the data which is provided to the platform by both drivers and customers? Who is in charge of driver background checks? If you are recruiting drivers, who is doing that? So you have to create specific rules to this activity, sharing the burden of regulation throughout the different players. A very important problem, in my view, one of the most important problems, is the workers' rights. People work for these platforms, and in the United States, there have been many court rulings qualifying drivers as proper, full-fledged workers of Uber, for instance. Meaning they are entitled to all the rights that workers have, employees have in a common employment situation. Some other courts, and that is the case of Uber, simply says we are just providing a service, an electronic service. We are just coordinating supply and demand. They don't work for us, they work for the driver. So we have absolutely no responsibility whatsoever to this driver. And this is aggravated by the fact that the wages, or better said, the percentage of the profit by the business is shared with Uber, and the income of the drivers is actually very low and very dependent of what Uber is allowing the driver to earn. So the driver, the earnings of the driver depends on the performance of the platform. The driver works under the instructions of the platform. The driver can only drive to customers selected by the platform. And however, the platform usually says, these are not our workers. They do not work for us. In my point of view, I think that new legislation must be adopted to make sure that if drivers are actually dependent on these platforms to perform their work, if they do not control their own performance and the rendering of services, then they should be deemed as employees of the platform so that the responsibility for them should be fully assured. We have been seeing a lot of problems with the drivers. Work exhaustion, having no working proper working conditions, working overtime. Some of the drivers have to work to 2-3 platforms at the same time. They work shift after shift, which also poses a safety, a security problem for the users of the platform as well. So it's something that must be addressed quickly as possible.
Mr. Sousa, I know legal experts really try to find every point, but we must now really come to an end.
Okay.
Because the time is running out in a half hour.
Okay.
I have to close the whole meeting.
Okay. Okay. I call just your attention to the problems of taxation and antitrust. The problem of taxation is usually these companies are seated in countries and providing those services from one country to many other countries. And this poses a problem of the sharing of the revenues of taxation, which is not being paid where the services may be rendered and are just being paid in a territory with better tax conditions. This is something that should be addressed and needs to be addressed on an European or multinational level. And also the antitrust issue. These companies tend to control the market. The strategy is usually to provide services with low prices, to remove out of the competition any other possible company, and then stay alone in the market to increase prices and have the customers on their control. Okay.
Thank you very much. Mrs. Mondera de Aguiar, you also take the floor there. Thank you.
Muito boa tarde a todos. Cumprimentar. Vou esperar que coloquem os auriculares. Cumprimentar o Sr. Presidente da Comissão. Cumprimentar também o caro companheiro, amigo e deputado nesta casa também, Dr. Luís Leite Ramos, o colega de painel e a todos vós. Sejam bem-vindos a Lisboa, a Portugal, e permitam-me que fale em português. Tentarei ser tão breve quanto possível, mas tendo em conta que no Parlamento Europeu o máximo são os 3 minutos, vou tentar não me alongar mais neste espaço. Já aqui foi definido, ou pelo menos trazido a definição do que é a economia de partilha, mas efetivamente aquilo que temos vindo a discutir ao longo dos anos é o próprio termo. Desde economia de partilha à economia colaborativa, a peer-to-peer economy, portanto, há uma série de definições que ainda estão por clarificar. O termo que está a ser utilizado nas instituições europeias no momento é, efetivamente, o de economia colaborativa. E como aqui foi referenciado, trata-se de um modelo de negócio onde existem três categorias de atores. Os prestadores de serviço, os utilizadores deste serviço, mas também os intermediários que, ao dia de hoje, são as plataformas online. Porquê? Porque hoje em dia vivemos na era da digitalização. Se em tempos passamos pela revolução industrial, hoje vivemos em plena revolução digital, tecnológica. E por isso é preciso adaptarmos a esta situação. E os legisladores, em termos europeus e também em cada Estado-membro, têm de cada vez mais adaptar-se e orientar a legislação no que diz respeito a estas novas tecnologias, salvaguardando os que fornecem os serviços, mas também aqueles que os procuram. Partilhar convosco que esta economia de partilha ou colaborativa não está apenas focada nos transportes, está referenciada também no alojamento local, está a crescer também no setor financeiro e nas competências online. E partilhar alguns dados referentes à União é que a dimensão da economia colaborativa em relação à economia total da União foi estimada em aproximadamente 26 mil milhões de euros. E a indicação que temos é que cerca de 394 mil pessoas estão empregadas na economia colaborativa. É certo que representa 0,15% do emprego, mas temos de olhar para estes novos empregos e de que forma é que vamos legislar para acolher este tipo de economia agora existente. Em Portugal, a economia colaborativa, segundo os dados que são da Comissão Europeia, apontam para que cerca de 8.400 pessoas estejam empregadas nestas áreas. É verdade que a economia colaborativa tem um potencial elevado, mas o rácio de Portugal das plataformas por 1 milhão de habitantes é ainda um dos mais baixos da União. Em Portugal são 3 as plataformas de economia colaborativa, 6 delas são internacionais e, como já aqui disse, são vários os setores, desde o financeiro aos transportes e às competências online. Dizer que os maiores mercados económicos colaborativos encontram-se em França, no Reino Unido, na Polónia e na Espanha. E foram identificados nestes mercados os principais benefícios da economia de partilha, como o aumento no acesso às oportunidades de trabalho autónomo, como o aumento das próprias oportunidades de negócio, a questão de desvalorizar o princípio de ownership, que até aqui era muito visto, aliás ainda é visto como a propriedade vista como um símbolo de status, e isto tem vindo a diminuir. A questão dos impactos ambientais, os pontos positivos que existem em termos de impactos ambientais no que concerne à partilha e à troca de bens de consumo. E também um ponto interessante, que é o acesso ao capital mais facilitado. Nós sabemos que a maioria dos bancos geralmente olha para as startups e para as pequenas e médias empresas como um investimento de alto risco, mas com esta crescente economia de partilha, o facto é que o crowdfunding, por exemplo, tornou-se uma maneira mais fácil e mais conveniente, quer de angariar fundos por parte das pessoas que têm uma falta de liquidez, conectando-as às pessoas que estão dispostas a investir. Um segundo ponto que trazia aqui para partilhar convosco é, de facto, aquilo que são as principais propostas da Comissão Europeia nesta temática. Têm lançado várias propostas, vários estudos, nomeadamente na economia colaborativa, no que concerne a plataformas de mobilidade e as plataformas de aluguer de curta duração, em Portugal chamado alojamento local, já lançaram alguns estudos. Contudo, deixo aqui também a crítica de que esperava que a Comissão Europeia tivesse dado um passo maior, no sentido não de apenas lançar as orientações gerais, mas de ter havido de facto uma vontade política de estabelecer algumas regras, algumas ações mais concretas. Neste sentido, partilhar que em 2016, já no decurso deste meu mandato no Parlamento Europeu, assisti à Agenda Europeia para a Economia Colaborativa, fui relatora neste relatório, onde identificamos, através também da Comissão Europeia, a necessidade da distinção entre peers e profissionais, a questão da responsabilização, que já aqui foi mencionada, a questão de que tipo de proteção oferece o direito europeu do consumidor aos utilizadores e também a questão das relações de trabalho. Sabemos que são competências nacionais de cada Estado-membro, mas, contudo, é necessário haver uma base geral em termos de melhoria das relações de trabalho e também mencionar a questão da fiscalidade. Em 2018, este ano, efetivamente lançaram-se vários estudos, um deles para avaliar a legislação que afeta a economia colaborativa no setor do alojamento local. Foram avaliadas cidades como Amsterdão, Barcelona, Berlim, Bruxelas, inclusivamente Lisboa, Praga e Estocolmo, mas este estudo ainda não foi publicado. Portanto, aguardamos também este estudo para ver que mais consequências podemos retirar para melhorar a legislação. Um outro estudo publicado também em 2018 para monitorizar o ambiente regulatório dos negócios que afetam a economia colaborativa, sendo que já deste estudo o que se concluiu foi que não existe uma única abordagem para a criação de um ambiente regulatório favorável, mas que, tendo em conta que são afetados vários atores da economia colaboracional, convencional e colaborativa, é preciso haver uma legislação, uma regulamentação sectorial. Apenas em abril de 2018 é que a Comissão Europeia lançou efetivamente as suas primeiras propostas legislativas no âmbito da Estratégia para o Mercado Único Digital. Propôs, portanto, novas normas, como aqui também foi referenciado a necessidade de novas normas, efetivamente em matérias de transparência e equidade relativamente a plataformas online, mas também a necessidade de termos maior transparência e maior eficácia na resolução de litígios nestas situações. Ainda é enunciado a potencial criação de um observatório da União para avaliar o impacto destas novas normas. Foi também lançada uma outra proposta, que julgo que tem que ver com aquilo que está a ser aqui discutido também, que se chama o New Deal for Consumers, ou seja, um acordo para os consumidores com novos direitos do consumidor em relação aos serviços digitais gratuitos. Partilhar que, enquanto deputado do Parlamento Europeu, também pude participar efetivamente em alguns relatórios do Parlamento Europeu, indicando alguns pontos e focando a necessidade de haver novos desafios legislativos para respondermos a esta nova economia. Portanto, em 2015, no primeiro relatório sobre os desafios e ideias para o fomento do turismo na Europa, e como este setor é tão influenciado, quer em termos de transportes, quer em termos de alojamento, com esta nova economia de partilha, incluí, em nome do PPE, um capítulo dedicado à economia colaborativa, especificamente para o turismo, onde pedíamos uma ação concreta da parte da Comissão Europeia com algumas propostas legislativas. Em 2016, um outro relatório sobre as novas oportunidades para as pequenas empresas de transporte, neste caso já incluindo modelos empresariais colaborativos, e aqui sim destacar três pontos muito sucintamente. A necessidade de atualizar as leis laborais nacionais face à era digital em cada Estado-membro, a importância, uma vez mais, de distinguir peer e operador profissional e uma revisão das normas relativas ao acesso às profissões, às atividades regulamentadas na Europa e também a tudo aquilo que está interligado entre os novos operadores e os serviços ligados às plataformas digitais. O que é que isto quer dizer? Tem de haver um melhor acesso à profissão e ao mercado e haver alteração das regras de transporte de passageiros, nomeadamente na questão dos táxis. Termino já, Sr. Presidente, dizendo que estas ações que tivemos no Parlamento Europeu devem ter reflexo quer junto da Comissão Europeia, mas também que sirvam de contributo para, nomeadamente aqui no Parlamento Nacional em Portugal, se melhorar cada vez mais, e sei que aqui já foi lançada esta nova legislação, para que se olhe para estes modelos de economia colaborativa com outros olhos, salvaguardando em termos de legislação aquela que é a vontade e a procura de cada vez mais consumidores, mas também uma questão fulcral que é a questão geracional. Há toda uma nova geração, presente e de futuro, que está ligada às novas tecnologias e que usa diariamente as novas tecnologias. Precisamos de encontrar enquadramento legal para que possamos trabalhar no presente e salvaguardar o futuro de quem está já na era digital. Muito obrigada pela atenção.
Thank you very much. When I'm not in Lisbon, at home in Vienna, I'm chairing the EU Committee. The EU Committee is just now, and there we have to debate is the topic better in the regulation of whole Europe or on the national level? It's called subsidiarity, proportionality. And I'm not sure that's really better on the side of the European Union. Otherwise, everything can be. Also, we know there is a new economy, new technology. We have to find. But I'm not since yesterday in politics, and I know that. We, for example, in Austria, we cannot make any regulation between the taxi driver of Vienna and in the surrounding because this is a war. So the regulation is absolutely stupid. You can take in the surrounding a taxi, go to Vienna, but when you are in Vienna with the taxi, you cannot take any guests out of the city because it's only allowed for the taxis which has the license in the city. Uber makes the next level of that. If you will try that, you will lose the mayor position in Vienna because the taxi driver are the most important communicator of politics, by the way. Luis, some closing remarks from your side, please.
Muito, muito brevemente, dizer que estamos no início da preparação deste relatório. Naturalmente vamos pedir o contributo do Parlamento Europeu e da Comissão em tudo aquilo que foi desenvolvido e aguardamos os contributos de cada um de vós relativamente a questões mais específicas de cada país, porque a realidade é muito diferente nos diferentes países, mas julgo que sobre o essencial, sobre aquilo que é a matéria que nos preocupa, os direitos dos consumidores, os direitos sociais e económicos dos trabalhadores e, por último, a questão da justiça fiscal, julgo eu que serão temas que permitem agregar os vários contributos e fazer um relatório que possa responder às expectativas e, no fundo, às necessidades de cada um dos países, mesmo se as problemáticas são muito diferentes. E, naturalmente, que agradecer os contributos dos nossos convidados, com quem vamos continuar a dialogar para aprofundar e desenvolver o relatório. Muito obrigado.
Thank you. You all heard the invitation from Luis, and I'm sure we will go on in the discussion about this important report. Please stay. We are coming now to the last report, but Serhii, really. Can you only open the debate with 3-4 sentences? I know it's not your best quality to be short, but you can try air quality and diesel emission in the urban centers, please.
Thank you for being frank and evaluating my best and worst qualities. I will definitely take it into account. Yeah, I will be extremely very brief because we are already all tired in the final stage. Just wanted to say that I'm really happy that we have decided to take up a report on air pollution. We now have realized, together with Aiste, the member of the secretariat who is helping me out with the report, and after the fact-finding mission to Copenhagen and having meetings with the European Environmental Agency, also meetings, I think very productive meetings with the World Health Organization, we have realized that we need to seriously reconsider the introductory memorandum, make it less technical, and add amend it in a way which reflects the current trends and tendencies, and the work is already being done. The recent reports which we are presenting, I have a few copies of them, so if any one of you wanted to look into and have more details, what's going on right now is some reports I have here with me that I picked up from the World Health Organization, also from the EU on air quality. So these are all the recent developments. There are certain things that really require very serious deliberation. And I also look forward to the support of the committee to organize a committee hearing, an exchange of views with the experts. I already have some ideas of who could be invited from different stakeholder representatives, from WHO, also from the municipalities. We talked extensively today about the role of municipalities in urban planning, and air pollution is a very, is a key issue there right now, is a huge impact on public health. So I look forward to continuing that work, and maybe, I don't know, in December, so we will discuss it within the Secretariat, we can have this exchange of views and present a revised introductory memorandum there. Thank you very much.
Maybe we can invite representatives of German cities which took action, the city of Paris with a very strong regulation and a very specific regulation, by the way. Milano, for example, that's but you see, in whole Europe, it comes to regulation now on the city level, and I think this is very important. Thank you very much, and if you agree, I close this topic. Now we came to the committee's work program and priorities. We have to send some representatives to following events. In Vienna, my hometown, there is Fundamental Rights Forum, and if you agree, I'm living there, no costs are coming, and I will go there. Yes, thank you very much. Second, the man who follows in the work of Louis Jean-Biergrin, we appointed him as a general rapporteur on local and regional authorities. And there is the next meeting, the 35th session of the Congress in Strasbourg from 6 to 8 November. We can appoint him there. Thank you very much. Last but not least, the plenary of the meeting of the Committee on Bioethics in Strasbourg 20 to 22 of November. Our rapporteur on protecting the rights of people with psychosocial disabilities with regard to involuntary measures in psychiatry, Mrs. Raina de Bruin-Wesemann, wants to go there. If you agree, we appoint her. But in the case that she not can go there, we also have Mrs. Stella Kyriakidis. In that way, we can go ahead. Thank you very much. We have more. Okay, there is more. So, the Lanzarote Convention. I see the Lanzarote, a meeting of the committee of the parties of the Lanzarote Convention in Den Haag from 7 to 8 of November. Who can go there? Lanzarote Convention. I look to Doreen. Perfect. Yeah. And we have the W. The WTO, no? With the Ad Hoc Committee on the Rights of the Child, 16 to 18 of October in Strasbourg.
Sorry? Yes, I can't go to that, but I suggest my colleague Lord Tuig, who is prepared to go to that one.
Okay, he did it in the past, and I think we can all agree into that, okay? And WTO, I thought I have WTO on my paper or not. No, yes, here, yes, here, yeah. So this is in Geneva from the 6th to the 7th of December. Who is interested to go there?
I think it's quite pertinent to the whole UK debate about Brexit and stuff like that. So
yeah,
I don't
stay,
know
it's better there, stay, but stay in the European Union. You have more time. Sir Roger Gale tells me the whole time he has no time to do his job because he don't know what is going on with Brexit or
yeah.
not.
But
maybe
use,
it's
yeah.
easier you follow the mayor of London and you make a second referendum and then it's much more
totally
easier.
I totally agree with the mayor of London,
yeah,
but we do have to know about what the options are. So.
But we notice that you, if the Brexit is not coming in that time, that you are ready to go. Yes? Thank you very much. Okay, then, now, what I have anything to do, what is this, the ILO conference? Now we should have some reports, but I can delete this item, because Mr. Hunko is not there, Valerio is not there, and Ion Marian Streuer is not there. Other businesses, the next date and place of the next meeting will be in October in Strasbourg. Second, the subcommittee on children. We spoke yesterday about that. There will be a joint meeting between the subcommittee on education, youth and sport and the subcommittee on children. It's on 2 days in Tbilisi in Georgia. And we hope to see a lot of you. Second, the subcommittee on the Euro Prize is on 28 in Ukraine, in Ivano-Frankivsk. Is somebody interested to attend there? If not, you don't need to tell me now. It's on the corner.
Around the corner of Lviv, but I'm not going to be there because I'm going to be in New York. But I would really encourage you, encourage the members who have never been to Ukraine to go to Ivano-Frankivsk. It's a beautiful town.
Yes,
far
that
from
is
the
true. But you
Ukrainian
know, I was
mountains.
Last week in
yeah.
your country, and so Europrize, Stella, you were thinking about. Ukraine is in the moment in the campaign.
And it's only 100 kilometers from Lviv, so very.
Yeah, nice. So that is maybe an argument. Yeah, it's in the western part of the Ukraine, next to the Karpat. What is wait? What do you mean? The dates I just said before, 28th of September. It's coming very close. Yes. But you can call us. You can call. You must. You don't need to tell us now. Yeah, please. Everybody can. I look to you, for example. It's not so far. The Vikings took the boat and moved to Kiev on the riverside. So
it was a different direction.
No. Yeah, I know where he is living. Huh? That's. He was on the. That was the beginning where the Vikings started to found Kiev. Eh? But it's okay. No. I'm not joking. Only a little bit because I'm happy about these 2 days. Thank you very, very much. You are.
Thank you.
You are really a great person, Luis. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You know, normally the chair invites the committee in his country. So Luis did now really brought a problem for me because I want to invite the social committee for 2 days to Vienna next year. And now I had a really high level. But I will try my best. And for those who participated in the nuclear debate, I can promise follow. I will go with you in the only atomic nuclear power point station which never worked 1 minute but is completely ready to do that. But then you see how it is if you have a referendum and when something is finished and the people decided with 50.8% never use it. So you will have a very interesting excursion. And don't forget, then you have to stay one night longer because it's in the surrounding of Vienna and we have to go by bus from Vienna to the nuclear power station. But you are totally safe, I believe. Yeah? You can walk, you don't need anything. Yeah? You can feel how is living without risk. Yeah? And that is maybe something nice. So I wish you now a nice evening, but I hope that we spend the evening together. First, with Madame Timmermans, we are going to the boat, which makes zero emission. And second, we go to the North-South Center for a reception. Everything starts here in front with buses. Is it right?
The buses will take you to the hotels.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay. So the buses will take you to the hotels and pick you up from the hotels to take you to the North-South Center. If you want to go to the boat with Mrs. Timmermans, you stay with Bogdana and Eister, who we are going to be probably taking. We also have a bus for that. But in that case, you don't go to the hotel, okay? So it's either hotel or boat, okay?
Either hotel or boat?
Yes. Yes, bus from here.
No, this is a hard decision.
Sorry. God. He'll be furious if he can't move it.
Sorry, the bus is now to the boat, or not? From here? Yeah, okay. To the hotels and to the boat. So get on the right bus, depending on where you want to go.
No, listen, I'm confused, Tanya. If I want to go to the boat, do I stay here?
Yes. You take the bus from here, and then you will be taken directly to the reception from the boat.
No. We are going.
No, to the boat.
To the boat. And then from the boat's reception. Is that right? Okay.
The only people who registered for the boat can go to the boat for security reasons.
Who is registered?
Giacomo 9, ora 14. Giacomo 1, ora 14. Stavo già prendendo due cose sul colore. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.